Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Bobby Jefferson. Bobby is DAI's first ever global head of diversity, equity, engagement, and inclusion. He was previously vice president and chief technology officer for DAI Global Health, helping establish DAI's successful digital and global health teams. In addition to his work at DAI, Bobby is a member of the board of directors and the chair of the DEI committee for the Society for International Development, Washington, D.C. chapter. Bobby is also co-chair of the Council of International Development Companies' new DEI committee and participates in British Expertise International's Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Working Group. Before joining DAI in 2016, Bobby focused on ICT for global health and adjacent sectors. In addition to his professional work, Bobby is a board member and advisor for various organizations focused on technology and supporting minority entrepreneurs. So, Bobby, thank you so much for coming on Tolerable Risk. I'm very excited to have you here today to talk about DEI efforts. Before we get into the technical part of the topic and all the great stuff you have to share with us today, can you just tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get into this work? How did you get into the third sector? And what are you working on now?
Thank you, Sabrina. I've been involved supporting development work for about 25 years. And my background is I am chief technology officer in the global health business unit at the company DAI. And my background has been on the technology work supporting PEPFAR, so the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. And so I spent a lot of time in many countries from Nigeria to Kenya, developing electronic medical records, digitals, solutions, innovations, and working on ICT, information communication technology solutions in the countries. And then prior to that, I worked and supported USAID, US Agency for International Development. And I spent a lot of time in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, Moldova, and those countries trying to address the issues around Y2K and other technology issues. And that helped me to really understand that solutions can't always come from the West or from donors, that many of the issues that we need to address have to be locally owned in order for it to be sustained. So I worked a lot of my efforts and focused a lot of time on local solutions, local communities. I then transitioned that type of work into being able to address, well, why are we sending two people who just graduated from university for 2 weeks of training to countries to share expertise when the expertise was always in country? Why is it that we didn't recognize women who are chief of parties or leaders and their opinions? And why is it as a development sector, when it comes to technology, you have different solutions, but always depend on the West or others to bring in solutions rather than homegrown and own solutions? So I personally experienced that dichotomy of that work. And so in my career journey, I tried to ensure that much of the staff that I worked with owned and ran and managed the solutions, that I would always have women or female chief of parties and leadership levels, how to encourage if you're working on in the field or in the projects, how do you progress in a career from working on the data or data entry and then moving up towards becoming a vice president within a company or organization so that you're in a position and just, address a lot of those diversity issues where at the top, the across the development sector, it wasn't reflective of who I am or where the work that we were doing and why is that and why it's causing that. And so I personally then started taking on that challenge of diversity, equity, inclusion as well. Then I was able to take on the full-time role within DAI of addressing diversity, equity, engagement, and inclusion and accessibility as well for DAI. So really trying to ask the question, why is the development sector we're so behind and not embracing diversity, equity, inclusion issues. What is the barriers and what are we trying to achieve in diversity, equity, inclusion? And why now? What's the urgency in that? So hopefully in our conversation, we can be able to talk more about that.
There's so much to dive into there, and I can't wait to get into it. And I have my own hypotheses and theories. Yeah. As to why the sector is the way it is, and maybe also even why now. My hypotheses and theories, though, come from the risk angle. And so I'm really excited to dive into that with you today. But before we kind of get in there, I want to start just talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion. And I noticed that you also added engagement and accessibility in there as well. And I think those are really great concepts to also be thinking about when we're talking about DEI. But let me start with this question. So when it comes to DEI, what do people get wrong? What do they misunderstand about this area of work, this technical knowledge base, and why do you think they get it wrong?
Yeah, so from a high level top view, right now, what I see in the development community is that diversity and inclusion or diversity, inclusion, accessibility is the hot topic of development for, past year and this year. And so right now there's been a focus on these themes as well. I've been doing this work for a long time. I've been doing work for diversity and inclusion, localization. And what I find is the development community has a very short attention span. And so right now—
Is it the development community, Bobby, or funders?
I would say both, right? So there are some development community nonprofits who have had as part of their mission before the funders to be much more inclusive. Of, for example, gender, right? So some of the roadmap has been like many organizations have a gender-centered approach long before the donors really, took up the mantle of gender inclusion. But now, because the donors and a lot of the social justice issues that have come to the fore, both the donors and the development sector have made it a hyper focus. And so the part that I'm concerned about is that as other issues occur in the sector, from Ukraine to food security, to other upcoming changes and issues in the sector, that diversity and inclusion will eventually or once again be get relegated back to either HR or it will become part of the continual work of development, either by the donors or by the development sector itself. And so how to make this sustainable? That's the part that I think we're not getting correct. And here's why I'm saying that. If I can be blunt, we are currently receive a lot of support from the donors in the current administration under the Biden administration as an executive order that support racial, ethnicity, diversity, and inclusion. The previous administration actually had an executive order banning diversity and inclusion types of training and work. I don't know what the future holds, but I do know that unless we take this diversity and inclusion to incorporate it into the DNA of our organization, there always will be this back and forth swinging and focus on diversity and inclusion, even though it should really be part of our core mission. Many organizations, NGOs, for-profits, and others pause their diversity work when it wasn't convenient to do so. And so how do you continue to sustain the work even when it's not the highest priority, when there's other competing priorities, when you don't have resources, when you're addressing other issues? That is for me where a lot of organizations, I'm trying to help them think through and just to get right. So that's why I put it on both the donors, but also development community itself. We can continue diversity and inclusion regardless of what the donors do if we're truly committed.
Well, it's interesting, Bobby, when talking about the diversity and inclusion, so certainly not the ebbs and flows of the administration, but when you were talking about how right now diversity and inclusion is sort of the new hotness, and if it starts to fade, it just gets kind of sent back down to HR or wherever. I feel the same thing about risk, right? I feel like people, especially in the third sector, are starting to realize that risk is something that they need to be thinking about in a more systematic way. And you see a lot more job openings and job roles being created, looking at risk, looking at compliance, but organizations are not really thinking through what that means and how it means a change in the way of working or integrating things that they might be a little bit uncomfortable at first. And so I see a lot of parallels between the expansion of risk kind of professionalizing in the third sector and what you're talking about trying to integrate DEI so that it's something that's truly sustainable. I think there's a lot of similarities there. For people listening right now, to make sure that everyone is understanding what we're talking about when we are talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion, People may have different understandings of that terminology. We might be having listeners where English isn't their first language. It might be something that could be kind of vague. So Bobby, could you talk a little bit just about, at its core, what are DEI efforts and programmatic elements? What does that mean to have DEI efforts in an organization?
Great. Thank you for that. So I do want to agree with you completely about the parallels with regards to risk management and diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility. So you'll hear these acronyms used a lot, DEI, DEIA, that's why it's accessibility. You also hear belonging, diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging.
JEDI is another one.
JEDI, yes, justice, right? So there's quite a number of acronyms. And the reason for those acronyms are because within this field, or the inclusion field, you're trying to be inclusive of the different ways that we show up as a person, as an individual, and as an organization, right? So there's diversity as an individual, there's diversity as an organization. And so there's different aspects of diversity. So whenever I do our new employee orientations or others, I always ask, well, what does diversity mean to you? Because it's not just race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, your socioeconomic status, your language. So we have native and non-native English speakers, age. Within my organization and the organizations I've supported, I've seen 5 generations, even of staff. And so that's an element of the generations as well, in addition to political perspective. So again, it's important to have all of those as part of the diversity conversation and definition. The equity part really means that we're all not starting from the same place. And so how do we acknowledge and address the imbalances that have occurred? Many organizations have started their diversity, inclusion, and equity journey only in the last few years after the Black Lives Movement or the issue that occurred with George Floyd. And so many organizations issued statements and made huge external statements and commitments. And so that's when a lot of organizations really started their journey. So whenever you use the word diversity, inclusion, that's a very nice corporate speak to be inclusive of everyone. But, you know, within the US and the UK, there are still issues regarding race and ethnicity and inequities and bias that need to be addressed. The area that I'm really focused on is engagement and inclusion. And engagement is around how do we ensure or have an opportunity for all of our staff, for all of the individuals to really engage in the work of the organization and the mission. There's excellent organizational data that says if you can achieve 70 to 75% engagement by your staff in your core mission and your work, where they put their hearts, their minds, the trust into the organization, you actually will have higher value coming out of the organization and the mission and much more dedication towards the organizational goals and work. So I actually emphasize much more the engagement aspect. And then of course there's inclusion, which means that regardless of who you are, that you're seen and valued in the organization. And that's hard. That's really difficult to become a truly, truly inclusive organization and leader. But the part that I want to just share with you around the parallels to risk management is not a tick the box exercise, right? And so you know, you've mentioned earlier around heat maps or matrices, and I believe in DEI world, it's similar. Like DEI is not a tick the box exercise. You can't just bring in consultants and have this matrix. And there's definite compliance and risk issues and dynamics associated with DEI as well. And so if you get it wrong, you can introduce issues that are hard to undo, where you're petitioning your organization based on race or ethnicity, or if they have sexual orientation status that they self-report, LGBTQ plus community, and saying, yes, we want to support them. But you may have staff or part of a community that has equal labor laws in Uganda, for example, or if you're working in the Middle East, how do you ensure and protect and address the risk with LGBTQ plus staff who want to self-identify or traveling to countries? And so that's a really important element of why it's not a tick the box and not just a risk or compliance issue as well. And so I think the methodology and approach that you have, Sabrina, around the objective is really a good one. And I've sort of applied that in our DEI world as well.
Yay. Hashtag say no to risk matrix. We love that here on Tolerable Risk. No, but that's actually really interesting. It's a really interesting side-by-side analysis, Bobby. You're absolutely right. It is not a box tick thing, right? I mean, if you really want to integrate real dynamic risk management, it has to be integrated into the ways of working. And exactly the same thing with DEI efforts, right? It has to be the way the organization breathes, right? Not just the socks that it decides to put on that day.
The part of diversity and inclusion that I think is important is you have to find out what works within your organization, right? So in order to prevent that box ticking exercise, what are the systematic changes that you can do or follow within an organization? So for example, if DEI is just relegated to the HR department and is not cross-cutting, then I can absolutely tell you what will happen is that it'll become much more a compliance function. It'll become much more just another HR issue rather than being part of the business and being part of our staff and our projects and part of our promotions and how we actually work as an organization. I highly recommend to many of our NGO groups that I sit on the board is how to infuse DEI as cross-cutting beyond just HR so that it's within finance, it's within legal, of course, but it's within projects and programs. And how do you get that so that it's part of the DNA of the organization as well? And that organizational change, much like risk management, is not easy. And
it's
that
not
cultural
easy.
Change.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you know what, Bobby, as you were just talking, I made a note here talking about just basically says inclusion equals whistleblowing, right? Because in my mind, from where I sit, if inclusion is something that is done well in an organization, it means wherever you are, wherever you're coming from, whatever you're thinking, you are welcome. You have that sense of psychological safety. People are comfortable to speak up and speak out. You are going to have more people who are raising their hands, not only to say, hey, wait a minute, something doesn't look right here, and alert an organization to something before it completely goes off the rails, but you're also going to have people who are going to raise their hand and say, hey, have we tried thinking about doing this in a different way? And it's going to stimulate more innovation. And that is also really great when it comes to risk. You know, people don't believe this, but I believe innovation is fantastic for risk because risk has two sides. You have the threats and you have the opportunities. And you will never be able to take advantage of those opportunities if you can't think creatively and innovate. And that links directly to inclusion. It links directly to a culture of inclusion.
Applause. You know, we've established within our organization, and I've tried to establish as best practice in other organizations, is, you know, the speak up line, right? So that psychological safety of encouraging staff and employees, and even those who are not staff and employees, to be able to speak up about issues. And unfortunately, in many organizations, HR isn't seen as a place where you speak up. I'm trying to encourage others to have this speak up mindset or speak up line. We have a speak up line. And as part of that is not just, I want to report a problem, but I just have a question. I have an inquiry around race or ethnicity, or I have a question about inclusion. Not just, I want to file a complaint or raise an issue, but I just have a question about how does diversity inclusion work if you're in the Middle East or in the MENA region? Or how do you self-report if you're an LGBTQ person and you're in Afghanistan or Egypt or countries where you want to be able to do it, but you also want to know if organizations will protect you? And you just have a question, you just want to speak up. So I'm definitely encouraging the establishment of speak up line. With my organization, those types of questions come to me and I'm the one who addresses them as well. I have confidential conversations that set up the psychological safety so we can talk about it. And more importantly, that there's a response that happens as well when you raise things. Because if you raise up issues or risks and you don't want the organization to be aware, part of that is you're raising it because you want the organization at some level to do something about it as well. So yes, they've raised it. Does it just go into a black box? Or is there action or follow-up or communication or even some change that's going to happen with regards to the issues and the risks and the DEI and inclusion that I rate. And so that's another important part of the speak up culture, speak up mindset that I'm trying to encourage both within my organization and in others.
Yeah, the feedback loop is something that's really important. And particularly when it comes to people that are providing suggestions or even providing reports, right? You need to make sure that you're balancing that feedback as well. Now, a lot of organizations can see these things as threats, right? I mean, organizations might see a feedback line as a risk. So let's talk about risks related to DEI. What are the real risks that an organization might face for not taking this seriously and not taking diversity and equity and inclusion and engagement and accessibility, taking these concepts seriously? What are the risks and the threats that they may face?
So the realistic risk is that events and situations that are happening within the organization and you're not aware of it, and it will become a major issue later. So for example, you can have a supervisor or a manager that's making sexual harassment issues and bullying comments or issues around race to staff. And what some of the staff will do, will just laugh it off. Oh, that's just, you know, what he's saying. And they just laugh it off, or will say, well, because the client is really enamored with that manager and he's really close to the client, I won't say anything now. I feel very uncomfortable. And what happens is, when those comments are made and when that situation happened, as a recipient, as an employee, as staff, as others, you feel it, you sit with it, right? And so this has happened to me as well, where we've had senior individuals who say, Bobby, hey, you know, for a Black American guy, you speak really well and you're really articulate. And then they move on to 10 other topics. But yet I'm the one who's, you know, introspectively thinking, well, what does that mean? I speak well. Do the other people not speak well? Is that with me? Is that a racial, ethnical issue? What's going on there? And you're constantly thinking internally and you're sitting. So even though it's a micro comment, there's a macro impact on your staff and the individuals receiving it. I can assure you, if they think about it, they keep it with them. And then every time you're in a conversation with them, you're always thinking about this. And then we've definitely seen cases where supervisors and managers that just go from project to project or from team to team, just causing situations of psychological unsafety with many of their teams. And just no one has spoken up about it until it becomes a crisis, until there's a discrimination suit, until there is issue where there's a high turnover in staff that are leaving, until, you know, you just didn't know because no one spoke up that, hey, you had a bad actor or a manager or supervisor or even consultants who are making all these comments and creating an environment that was not psychologically safe for your staff. And then when the true impact occurs is when staff are leaving, they don't want to work for that manager anymore. There's always this unspoken stance around the organization not being a place that you want to work or that has the trust, or you don't want to go to HR. I've seen this in many other, especially nonprofit organizations. If that person is quote unquote protected by the executive director and others, staff absolutely don't want to speak up. So it's a risk both internally and externally as well. You start to have not just a reputation, but you start to have types of individuals who are high performers who no longer want to work for you or be associated with you, and you'll never know why.
Those are really good examples. I mean, everyone, I think, immediately thinks about the lawsuits, the harassment, maybe the financial loss that comes along with it. But what you just touched on the end is something else I really want you to talk about, right? The loss of those high performers, the loss of the creativity, the loss of the innovative solutions and programs that you might have been able to benefit from as an organization, but because diversity and equity and inclusion were not something that were important to the leadership of the organization or the organization's general culture, you've lost that. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because everyone immediately thinks about a lawsuit, but you have a much larger area where people are just doing the quiet quitting or just moving on, and you're really losing out on value there. Can you talk about that?
Yes. So I sit on the board of a number of nonprofits, and I try to advise them on this important topic around diversity, inclusion, speaking up, and how to retain, attract your high-performing, high-potential staff. So for example, let's say you are a local nonprofit or just a global nonprofit, INGO, and you're doing work around gender and trying to infuse gender empowerment in different countries. But as our organization, your staff realize that you're not walking the talk, that when it comes to your own organization, you don't have women in leadership positions when it comes to gender issues, and especially women of color or race and gender. You don't have that presented in your leadership. When it comes to diversity and inclusion, you have to be able to walk the talk. So if we're going to talk to communities, if we're going to talk and engage in development and work and collaborate with our peers in countries to talk about gender, LGBTQ, and other issues, we want to be able to do it from place of trust, where our staff, our high potential staff, our high performers can absolutely believe what we're saying. And so it's when that dichotomy happens where within the organization, you're saying, hey, we support gender, we're going to be doing these programs. We support women, women of color. We do all these great things. But yet within our own organizations, hey, we're not promoting, or we have comments, or we're not reconciling the issues internally. One of the frameworks that I use is working from the inside out. You work from inside your organization to address these issues. And then once you work from the inside, that put you in a stronger position to be able to really talk about it externally and have some transparency about it, and then be able to engage with communities to be able to help them along with their journey as well.
So that's a really, this takes me into my next question, right? Some organizations, particularly small to medium-sized organizations, may want to really move into this area because they understand that it's extremely important and valuable for them to be able to make a positive impact in their communities that they're serving, but they're scared or they're hesitant, or they see it more as a minefield than as a garden with flowers and trees, right? They're really afraid to put the wrong foot forward. I will tell you this story. I was in a conversation with a leadership team and we were talking about diversity and equity and inclusion. And the CEO basically said, well, we don't really want to make too many external statements. We don't want to say things publicly because we might be held accountable to what we say. And what if we just can't do it? I understand that that is genuinely how some leadership teams think and feel. So what are some things that you can advise, Bobby, for leadership teams that might acknowledge this is important, but maybe they're afraid for good or bad reasons to move into that area? What can you advise them to help kind of build their confidence to move into this area?
Yeah. So one of the things I advocate for is to have a framework around responding to social justice issues. And what do I mean by that? So both Gartner Group and others have put out a lot of good material and framework, and I'm helping a couple of organizations that I sit on to address the same topic. So many organizations, NGOs, put out statements regarding Black Lives Matters movement, George Floyd, and they issued external statements in support. When there was issues concerning the Asian hate and the violence that was occurring in the U.S., some organizations put out statements. When it came to climate, many organizations have put out statements around climate change and science and climate's real. When in the U.S., issue around the U.S. Supreme Court ruling around same-sex marriage, some organizations put out statements, many did not, others did internal. And so what I tried to educate and advise boards are you need to have an approach to addressing social justice issues within the organization as part of governance. And that approach could be framework of we're going to address things based on principle. So these are our rules of the road. These are our principles. These are our missions. So rather than being reactive, you can find a way to put together conversations and decisions based on either your principles or a framework, or you can actually have a decision tree. But it's better to have those governance and conversations now before the issues arise. And so it could be, hey, there's going to be more issues, of course, regarding social justice, diversity, inclusion, gender. And so being able to just have, we're going to establish a team and we're going to make a decision that says our decision is not going to put anything external, or we're going to make a decision around internal only communication. And why that's important, because from a government's perspective, you need to have a framework or a process of saying we're going to stick to our mission and values and principles, or we're going to go down a set of principles that says our approach is we're going to make no statements at all on any issues externally at all, and no issues internally. And if that's the case, just being able to say that's our approach is an important element of governance as well, because then the staff know that, hey, our organization doesn't put out statements or address any of these issues. So they're not going to have this conversation internally or externally. Others have taken the approach that, hey, these are important topics, climate change, diversity, inclusion. And so we're going to make internal communications, but it's based on our internal principles. And then others have gone to a rules-based framework. But the important part is have in place an ability to not just react, but being prepared in advance of how you plan to react to these different topics, especially if you're a global organization or a global NGO, because rather than just being reactive, just putting in that governance or that communication or that playbook in place of here's what we're going to do when these types of situations occur.
So you want to have some consistency around it. You want to be able to have a framework, just like what you were saying.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Because without a framework, you're just going to make decisions at the board level, the CEO level, where there could be no reaction, you know, but every time something comes up, you'll be in that situation without just saying, okay, this is how our approach is.
So let me ask you though, Bobby, $1 million question. In this day and age, in this environment, can third sector organization really afford to not make these statements?
The question comes down to, in my mind, is both one of internal and external mission. Are you going to live the values of your mission? If your mission statement is around helping others, supporting the community, being inclusive, there's many local nonprofit organizations that the reason why they were set up was to serve and help others. And so if that is part of your mission, and as an NGO or private organization, then finding and aligning your communications to those principles is important. You just have to make the judgment, of course, around when and where you apply that. But that's the important part. Is the inclusion, are these statements part of your mission? And if you say that it's not part of your mission, then your staff will realize that, hey, you're not being faithful to the mission of the organization. And so I want to go in a different direction. Or your staff will feel much more affirmed that, yes, when these difficult and complex conversations occur, as an organization, I know that I'm with an organization that affirms and will stand through and believe in the mission and the values that they espouse. Because again, back to the employee and staff, the fastest way to lose the trust is when you make decisions that go counter to what you say is your mission and values. You have to be able as an organization, as a nonprofit, to show where you've either sacrificed or actually live the mission's statements that you're actually saying. If you don't live it, if you don't demonstrate it, if you don't have case around it, your staff will absolutely know.
I love it, Bobby. I love living the values of the organization. I'm going to write that on a post-it note and put it in front of me because I think that's great. Like, that's a great mantra to have. And it's very simple and it is quite impactful, right? And that might need to be the only question that is asked when one of these social justice issues comes up. And if an organization is going to make a statement on it and just say, are we living the values of our organization? And leave it at that. So let's say we have some folks who are listening to the podcast today, and they're really passionate about this, but maybe they feel like their organization is sitting in the wings, kind of dipping their toe in the water, but not doing enough. And they want to make a case for really engaging more clearly and in a more kind of structured approach around DEI. What advice can you give for folks to convince leadership management, make a big business case for this, that they should be putting resources towards this effort?
Okay, so I will potentially use the word business case, use a framework working from the outside in. All right, so I'll start with many of the nonprofit organizations that I'm associated with receive funding from USAID or FPDO, formerly DFID, or the EFI or Gates Foundation or Rockefeller Foundation. So many of the NGO groups that I support receive their funding from those types of organizations. USAID has already issued a statement around diversity, equity, inclusion, and have actually issued an equity assessment report around the importance of DEI as part of their donor-centered work. And so you can go to USAID website or on the Equity Action Plan, where USAID has designated in 100% of the missions an inclusive development officer. So that way, within each country, an NGO partner or local organization can have someone within USAID to go talk to about equity and inclusion issues within the country. So first part is the major donors being able to put this as part of their work and as part of their funding. Recently, the UK House of Commons issued a racism and development report. And part of those recommendations is the inclusion of DEI reporting into FCDO procurements as well. And then the EC has the anti-racism action plan. So if you receive funding from the EC Commission and EU, each of them have a diversity and inclusion person at the executive levels as well. So just from a business case and a funding standpoint, Gates Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, all the major foundation donors, FCDO, USAID, EU, EC, all now have diversity, equity, inclusion, anti-racism as part of their work and their journey. So you should be able to, from the business standpoint, you can demonstrate clearly how, just like managing evaluation, just like gender inclusion, the diversity inclusion is now part of the donor procurement process. So that's from the business side. But the second part is, what happens to your organization if you don't include diversity inclusion as an area to address? And I can tell you that there was a survey called the Bridge Survey that surveyed over 600 NGO groups, international organizations, both in the US and UK. And I can assure you that many organizations are just at the beginning part of their journey. So if you think about a maturity model, where the beginning, early stage, middle stage, or the mature stage, many of the development sectors, NGO organizations are at the very early stage, where they either issued a statement or not, or they have some diversity or not. But the important part is that if your mission and values is to help support countries and communities, have a representation within your organization that reflects those communities as well. During the pandemic, and this is, again, I went from the outside, now going back to the inside. During the pandemic, many organizations, NGOs, big NGOs and small NGOs, could not travel, right? They couldn't travel during the pandemic for almost a year, maybe 18 months. So how did the work occur if you can't send two consultants or two individuals to visit the different countries? How did the work occur? Well, hey, what happened is many NGO groups relied on and supported their in-country staff and leaders to do the work. Many of the staff who are already leaders, project leaders and chief of parties or leaders within your NGO group did the work, and they did it local. And so you've already demonstrated or proven the importance of having those leaders lead the work, do the initiatives as well. And so the diversity and inclusion lens that I'm trying to ensure is that coming out of the pandemic demonstrated that you've got leaders within your countries, you want to make them part of the solution going forward. You want to retain their project leadership skills. You want to enhance that. They've demonstrated and came through. Let's reward that. So if you're an organization that is hesitant around it, I always try to take the lens of the approach first, the donors. Second, that our project leaders during the pandemic have led the way in supporting our work, even though many folks from headquarters couldn't travel.
Let me ask from a kind of very specific angle, right? What advice could you give small to medium-sized organizations that might not be working with these larger donors with Gates Foundation, might not be coming at this from a compliance point of view, but maybe it's the charity down the street that is working with animals. Maybe it's one that's working with elderly people or an environmental group, and they want to make sure that DEI is part of their organization as well. What would you suggest for them to really be able to, and I hate to say justify putting resources towards it, but a lot of organizations feel that way. What advice would you give them?
So for mid-size and smaller organizations that I've been supporting, the element that they can take that work is to be able to look at their mission. So let's say it's on climate, or it's on, if they're a charitable organization. And as they begin to do hiring of staff as well, there's the notion that there isn't enough resources, for example, to have a chief diversity officer or these other types of offices within a smaller organization. So usually the head of HR or the head of compliance will wear multiple hats, where he or she would be responsible for inclusion and diversity and HR and getting the grants in. One of the areas, of course, is on the recruitment side, as they began to outreach to interns, as they outreach to staff that they want to hire. Just having lens around, are you ensuring that you're being much more equitable and looking at the types of individuals that you want to bring on to your mission? And so they could be people with disabilities. It could be people who don't look like you. So being able to have them for interviews and have them as part of the organization. Another part is being able to leverage some of the free resources that are available as well, right? So there's a lot of free resources and organizations. Creed as one, where we hold learnings. And so if you're a charitable organization, how do you learn the diversity and inclusion approaches from other similar sized organizations and how to share that knowledge? So both Creed and some of the work that I'm doing on the SID side, where we have smaller and micro organizations, and we just set up these learning communities where the groups are just learning from each other. Like, here, I came across this great tool. Here's some free trainings. Here's what's worked for me. We've done a small test and we found that by recruiting at different universities, that works for us. Or if I put out a statement around diversity, inclusion, and gender, that attracts candidates because they see that I've got that as part of my mission. And so now I've got more candidates. So I'm always encouraging charitable organizations, mid-sized, smaller organizations to join associations that have learning communities. So you don't have to have all these expensive consultants. And then the last part of that is what's offering up a vision of where are you going as well. So when we talk about diversity and inclusion, I always try to ask. So you take a snapshot of where you are today and just ask, okay, great. You want to do diversity and inclusion. It's important. You want to do gender. What's your theory of change? But what's your vision for 2030? Like, what's the direction? You want to become more of an anti-racist organization? You want to become more of an inclusive? So just being able to raise those conversations is also helpful, but doing it in the context of webinar or you're bringing in and associating with a knowledge management group. So that way you don't feel alone. You're not just the only one raising it.
I like that idea that communities of practice or that you're describing where smaller organizations or microorganizations, as you said, can find these communities where they can learn more about this area and maybe say, oh, okay, you're facing this challenge. I'm facing it too. How did you solve it? Or maybe we can work through this together. That's great. The wisdom of the crowd in a way in this area is probably a good thing. You mentioned boards earlier, and I definitely want to dive into that because people know if they listen to the podcast, we always have a special section for board members, trustees, or folks who are considering being a board member or a trustee of a third sector organization. A lot of times these folks are volunteers. Their hearts are in the right place, but they don't necessarily have the experience or the expertise of being on a board before. And that's okay. If somebody finds themselves on a board and they know that DEI efforts are really important, what are some questions that they can ask as a board member or data that they can request? Because we know we don't want board members up to their elbows in the day-to-day activities of an organization, but tone at the top is really important. And tone at the top in this area, as well as risk coming from the board, is really valuable. So if you're advising fresh trustees, fresh board members on small to medium-sized nonprofits, what can they do to demonstrate their support for and really encourage organizations to move into the area of DEI?
Yeah, so as board members, I would suggest bringing up DEI as a topic. So being able to just during the board meetings, just being able to ask question around, does the organization have a DEI strategy, plan, or a commitment? And usually that's a perfunctory answer. Yes, right? Usually they'll say, yes, we have one somewhere or we have one, but just first raising the question. The second part of that becomes, great, what does that commitment look like? Does that mean that we are putting together a strategy? Because oftentimes you can recommend to have as an organization's 3-year and 5-year strategy that there's an item for DEI to be included. Or you can also, as board members, one of the things that I've asked is succession planning. Is there a DEI diversity element to succession plan? So for example, if you have board members themselves, they often have limited terms. Or if you have a CEO or you have their senior leadership is reporting to the CEO, the question I raise is, in the senior leadership's succession plan, have they identified diverse candidates who don't look like themselves, are not the same gender, or just don't look like themselves as part of the succession plan? Because within every organization should have, for at least the CEO level and board members themselves, succession plan that says, here's at least one or two individuals that can succeed me if I win the lottery, you know, and I'm not around the next day that can step in and take over. So as a board member, you can just easily ask those types of questions. Right? Do you have a succession plan? And what percentages in that succession plan do not look like the same individuals? The third one is when we are on board meetings and the organization is trying to raise funds or go after additional funds or trying to partner with organizations, are you doing outreach to non-traditional partners as well? For example, have you outreached to LGBTQ-owned or women-owned or Latino-owned businesses and other NGOs to be able to work with and work together with? Or are you continually working with the same set of people and organizations doing fundraising campaigns or you're outreaching as well? So just by asking those three types of questions, succession planning, which is part of governance, the diversity of partnering and supplies, and then around the recruitment side of things in terms of strategic planning, like is there a DEI element in strategic plan? Felt that helps to raise the questions and the ability for boards to introduce the topic of DEI within the organization.
Those are great suggestions. Those are very tangible suggestions too, Bobby. I especially like, do you have something in your strategic plan that puts something on paper? It keeps people accountable. What does your succession look like? Do you have folks in the pipeline that don't look like you? And if you don't, then are we doing the outreach efforts? A lot of times organizations are saying, we don't want to have quotas. We don't want to commit ourselves to something. But a lot of it has to do with just the outreach, right? Are you trying to recruit at universities that historically have minority students, or maybe aren't your typical humanitarian development, third sector practitioners, and also the vendors, right? Are you trying to support your community organizations? You don't even have to go far away. Are you able to resource locally? Is there something in our backyard? And that helps your local community, and they're often underserved as well.
And as I mentioned at the beginning, many organizations have between three to four generations of staff. And so at the board level, try to also introduce the topic of youth, right? And that's a diversity element that often gets lost. Do you have at least one board representation or senior leadership that is a representation of our early millennials or Gen Z? And because I find if you have at least the board level or the senior leadership level access to our Gen Z staff and colleagues, that perspective is very different and very important. Because in my generation, when we're talking about governance and working, the approach we took to work was, you know, we're very happy to get a paycheck. We showed up to organization. Many of my Gen Z colleagues and early millennial colleagues, their approach is very different as well in terms of being digital oriented. They ask, I've been in recruitment interviews, what is the diversity profile of the organization? How can the organization help affirm the work that I'm doing? Can I show up as my full authentic self as well? Or do I need to be inauthentic in my work? And so just by having like a non-voting, but board member who was a representation of the Gen Z or the early millennial community, or having that as part of a diversity council is an important step in being inclusive and having that voice of inclusion in the room.
I'm so glad that you've brought that up a few times today, because I think age inclusion is something that people don't think about. I read a lot about how it goes the other way too. I mean, you have a lot of the, you know, okay boomers, right? The silver haired folks, but you know, it's funny when I talk to them and they're like, oh, you know, I'm so old. And I'm like, no, you have wisdom, right? But a lot of organizations might look at those folks and be like, you know, too old, too senior, whatever, won't fit in the operating environment or just not the right fit for the culture. I hate that. I hate when people say that. And you're like, well, what does that actually mean? Are you actually discriminating because you think they're too old? What does that mean? You're not comfortable with this person, or it's just not the right fit? Like, that's not a good reason.
Oh, that's a definite DEI issue, right? Whenever you find yourself within an organization saying, hey, that person isn't the right fit, that means you're still in the early stage of your DEI journey, right? Because I can tell from my personal perspective, when I've tried to look at individuals and people that I'm either promoting or interacting with, try to open my perspective and my periphery to say, for example, I'm mentoring and coaching people who don't look like me or who do look like me. And what do I see as a leader or a person that has potential leadership skills? And so I try to take a broader perspective, trying to adjust culture that quote unquote fits. And that's where that self-introspective and that reminder, and that's where some of the inclusive language and training comes from. If you're using that term cultural fit, then that means that you're still not yet mature as an organization or a leader. It's a much more way of excluding individuals without having to really give them a reason why, other than they aren't a good quote unquote cultural fit.
Yeah, it's usually pretextual, and that's never any good.
There's a whole course on.
Oh, yeah. All sorts of lawsuits on that one, too. We won't go down that road.
That's what we're trying to do, is change the outcome.
Exactly. It's got to be the way the organization breathes, not the socks it puts on.
Yeah, the DNA of the organization. And the last part for the board is you should be talking to other board members around board readiness and being able to identify individuals in your network. And I'm happy to do this. My network of people who are also board ready, right? And so as board opportunities come up, being able to push for, hey, there's a network of people that are board ready that I want to make sure to put on your radar and that I recommend for you to talk to. And I've benefited from myself where I've been in a situation where there's a board member, she was there, and she actually stepped down from the board and nominated me to participate on the board because she wanted to live the values of diversity and inclusion. So being able to really have board members who are willing to walk the talk, but also make recommendations for others within the network. And it takes work. It really does. It takes genuine work to extend our network. So I'm happy to help out, happy to make recommendations, especially on the different boards that I am and when those board opportunities come up.
That's fantastic, Bobby. And I like that too. It's not necessarily just what can a sitting board do as they're doing oversight of their organization, but look at themselves and say, are we where we need to be? Are we representing the diversity and the inclusiveness that we want to be modeling for the organization that we're responsible for? That's a great point of view as well. So for folks who are listening who have been really interested in the conversation and they want to learn more, they want to be able to improve their knowledge around this topic today, what do you suggest for continuing education around DEI?
So I have three areas. One is please follow me on LinkedIn or put out a connection, because on my LinkedIn profile, similar to your post, I post about free and open webinars and learning and communities of practice that you can join and participate in. That's number one. The second one, of course, I mentioned is around CREED, Coalition for Racial, Ethnic, Equity, and Development, to be able to participate and join there. So we have a knowledge management there. Let me also give a shout out to Fiona McCauley, the Wild, so the Women in Leadership Development as well. It holds great knowledge management and community of practice, both learning and videos, platform are accessible. So that's an existing sort of network and how to get involved, whether or not you're a small NGO or a charity organization, to just get involved in the community is hugely, hugely important, because you're not alone. Don't want you to be alone. You don't know that others are facing the same challenges, and we're here to help and share knowledge. The second part, there are free courses that you can take. So the ones that I highly recommend, and every course that I recommend, I personally have gone through, I'm taking myself, on Coursera, there are free diversity and inclusion courses that you can take. And so one is from ECOS, from the Harris School. I like the Coursera ones because their diversity and inclusion course are about local and global organizations, and their examples that they use are non-US. So they're around Middle East companies or countries, or around organizations like L'Oreal in France. Those case studies that they use are much more European or African or Southeast Asian. So eCoursera is free because you can audit the costs. This course is for free. And there's a diversity inclusion in the workplace course that I've taken. I highly recommend. It's about 4 to 6 weeks. I think it's also multiple languages. It gets in Spanish and French as well. In the U.S., the Cornell University has a fantastic course. The evaluation criteria that I use around the courses is, do they allow you to take what's learned and apply it to your work, right? And so that's why some, like the Coursera one or the Cornell ones, they actually have a facilitator, and that person works with you to take your existing issues that you have today in your organization, and you talk and share your problems and issues with other peers for taking the course. And then you come up and you work on specific solutions that are for you and for your organization. So rather just being than just generic learning on microaggressions or anti-racism or topics on diversity, inclusion, and difficulty in the workplace, you work on these topics, but you come up with solutions specific to you. And for me, that makes a huge difference.
Perfect. And I'll also add some links to the show notes as well, so people can find access to the Coursera courses that you're referencing, as well as some of the other frameworks and readings that you suggested earlier. Were we to wrap up? I'm sorry. Bobby, is there anything that you want to add as sort of parting wisdom? Anything that we didn't cover that you think small, medium-sized organizations, low to no resource, should really be focusing on or not afraid of anymore about the risks associated with DEI?
Yeah, if I can just leave with the comment or the statement that you're not alone in your diversity and inclusion journey. Please embrace it. It will really help as an organization for you to be aspirational and perform better, both as an organization, but you're not alone. You're not the only one. So please join and participate in the community. You'll find that the topics you talk about, the staff within your NGO, you already talk about. Like they already are over tea or other things, or coffee. They already are having these conversations. Just keep making that space and awareness for it to occur within the NGO community, within your group. So you're not alone. This is not a fad. And hopefully you can help to make this part of your journey for the next years as well. No matter what else happened, that this becomes part of the DNA of how you operate, that you always have a diverse staff. You always have diverse leadership. You always include women and those in your circle as part of the solution. Those are worthy goals.
That's great. So it's a lot like risk, right? It's built in, not bolted on. We want DEI to be really integrated. Fantastic, Bobby. I love it. So if people are really enthusiastic, engaged, more curious based on our conversation, where can they find you? Where's the best way to find and reach out to Bobby Jefferson and get in touch with you?
The best way is by LinkedIn. Bobby Jefferson, I'm on LinkedIn and I work at DEI. And you can both follow me or just send a LinkedIn request, noting Sabrina's fantastic podcast, encouraging students, university students, because again, when I have opportunities across development for university students to get involved in DEI effort, I want you to be there and let you know what those opportunities are. So students, practitioners, those who are just getting started, because it's not just me, right? So when I connect, I want to make sure you be a part of the network and that sharing. So that's why I want to make sure you get involved in the global network that's occurring right now.
Fantastic. Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Bobby, for your time today and for your wisdom. And really, it's been such a great conversation. And I've learned a lot, and I'm sure that the folks listening have learned a lot too. So thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. This has been a wonderful, engaging conversation.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.